in the 90s. Yes, I could do that. I read on the internet that he could recall a past life as a soldier in the Crusades and another past life as a ghost. Thank you. Really? I haven't heard that. Got to be fast. He said, can I talk a bit about your meeting with Reverend Jana Wimler? So, yes, I can. Is that what you wanted? She said, I'd talk a bit. I was just this, I don't know too much of him. But I did meet him once, and he was a very simple monk. He would just basically walk all over Sri Lanka, even when he was really old. Never actually stay in one place for two rage retreats at a time. So very much a wandering monk, German. And it did happen when I went to go and pay respects to the monk Venerable Pier Dasi, who come here sometimes. And in this monastery, Vajirarama Monastery, over in Colombo, in, just outside of Colombo, yeah. So anyway, we went there, and that was with, it's not here, Bianca's partner at the time, and another monk. And so I just went to pay respects, and first of all, I just really was really touched by the monk's humility, because we just walked a couple of hours to get there, and then when we got there, he said, oh, you must be thirsty, do you want a cup of tea? And I thought that, you know, you just go and order one of the novices or young attendants to get you a cup of tea. He just made it himself for us. This really big monk made us a cup of tea. So when I open the door for you, or, you know, you ask if you want a glass of water, that's just what a monk really should be like. Not always be wanted to treat it like royalty. So, and then he said, oh, would you like to pay respects to Bhikkhu Bodhi was there? Which was, you know, quite a surprise. So he went to see Bhikkhu Bodhi. And he said, oh, you've got a few other sort of interesting monks here. And one of those was Jnana Wimler. So you should just go and pay respects to this German monk. So he went in there. And then he came out an hour later. And then old Bhikkhu Bodhi said, where have you been? I said, oh, we were just in his room. He gave us a nice Dhamma talk. What? No, he never gives Dhamma talk, never to me, said Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. And so he was not upset or angry, but really surprised. It was one of the best Dhamma talks I'd ever heard. Can't remember what it was, but certainly inspiring. Same as my Dhamma talks. What did he say? Oh, it's really inspiring, but I'm not really quite sure, except for the jokes. Why is the mind tired if you meditate for a long time? If it is short, it's energetic, but after a long period, it gets tired. It's because you were pushing it. It means if you're meditating a long time, if your car is going on a long journey, of course it runs out of fuel. But if you keep your car in the garage, it's not moving at all. It's not going anywhere. Then you don't waste for fuel. In fact, the fuel starts to build up. And so if you meditate a long time, it's not the magic amount of time, but the depth of the meditation, then you get energized. Which brings me on to Ajahn Chah's simile. Because people thought to really get into deep meditation, especially to get things like enlightenment, you have to sit still for long periods of time, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. To beat your PB, your personal best. How long can you sit? And Ajahn Chah would say, we call that chicken meditation. Because a chicken can sit on the eggs for about 5 or 6 hours without moving. But does a chicken get enlightened? Does a chicken get into jhanas? Of course not, just get sore bottom. So, if it's not the length of time, it's the depth of meditation. And if you get into deep meditation, it's not the long time, you really deep meditation, then you get energized. Early this morning, as I was meditating, I saw a few sparks of light appearing in the corner of my eye. They usually seem to appear either at the corner or just below my eyes. If they ever appear up front, they appear just as a flash, and then it's gone. Strange thing I realize these flashes appear, usually the moment my mind starts drifting into other thoughts. What can this be? It's because you're drifting into other thoughts. So in other words, no, just little flashes of light, just go for the big one. So don't drift off, just make peace more. Also, the sparks of light that come when I'm really focused on my breath are quite distracting and end up breathing, breaking my focus. Please advise. You shouldn't really be focused on the breath, you should just allow the breath to be focused on you. So you're just sitting there doing nothing. And then the breath comes to you. Oh, fine, welcome breath, you can stay as long as you like. And if you're very kind to the breath and very friendly, the breath hangs out for a long time. And if the nimitta wants to come and pay you a visit, oh, okay, thank you, nimitta, for coming in. You can stay as long as you like. You don't have to, I'm not going to chain you to the chair. You can actually come and go whenever you like. And then the nimitta just stays with you. It's all about the stillness, the calmness, and the kindness. Especially the stillness and the kindness. Be kind. Be still. And then these things stay with you. But don't try. Dear Ajahn, you have made a profound statement. Well, you know, if you give enough talks, just by chance, one day you will say something profound. It's just probability theory. What did I say? Your nimitta is dirty because your practice is poor. So long before we sit on the cushion, we must at least observe 5 precepts and learn to forgive others and show metta. Thank you. Yeah, it's not you must, but it helps. Helps enormously. Usually what is profound is something you don't understand. Because I was doing that when I was the sound of one hand clapping, your face before you were born. And I thought, wow, that is so deep. I can't understand it, therefore it must be profound. And then, when you explain everything, and people understand, oh yeah, Ajahn Brahm, yeah, but he doesn't go deep enough. Why? Because we can understand it. So be careful there. What is usually people say is profound, is what they don't even understand. Is it possible to reach the first jhana when you hold on to attachments? I'm missing family now that I've been away for a few days. But are they missing you? Yay! God! Ooh, party, freedom! Just make sure your family cleans up before you get back. Well, we miss family, but no, you'll be much, much, much better with your family when you go home. So you miss them, but it's much better for you. Sometimes you go to overseas, you know, for business, or for shopping, or for, not me, obviously, or for golf, I don't know what you go overseas for. And, you know, it's not your family. You come together for a while and then you part. You can't be with each other all the time. But, you know, that you learn how to, for the sake of your family, for their happiness and well-being, that you will actually be peaceful and calm and develop some really nice attitudes of mind. And that means your family, when you get back, they're happy you're back. Because sometimes, you miss your family, and it's a waste of time if when you get back that you're worse than you were when you left. That's a waste of time. But if you're much better, of course it's a wonderful thing you've done for them. When you meditate, it's not just for your own benefit. It's for the benefit and happiness of all those people, including your family, who have to put up with you. In other words, you go home a much better product. So, you miss your family. Do you miss your family when you go to work on a sort of a Monday morning? Of course, because you're putting importance into what you're doing at work. Here you're putting importance into what you are doing, sort of in this meditation. So hold on to attachments. Oh, there is a time we have to learn how to let go, and then when we go back, we're much better people. So no need to hold on to attachments. Yesterday you mentioned that Lord Buddha delayed the sunrise to allow a monk to attain arahatship. Yeah, weird, isn't it? I read in another instance he had a dispute with Devadatta in a potter's residence and delayed the sunrise to save Devadatta. Are you doubting these? Who knows? Maybe it's true. Maybe it's not true. But what is true is just the extent people will go to try and encourage a person to do something so wonderful as to get into jhana or to get enlightened. That's wonderful that people go to, the teachers will go to so much trouble to make sure that people have the supporting conditions so people can develop their practice. I think that is a very wonderful lesson for that. That's how much trouble we can go to help others. Dear Ajahn. Okay. Wolf. I think I'm a dog. A Pavlovian dog. Even when meditation is rather pleasant, I still have to stop at 10:30 a.m. and 5 p.m. It's compulsive. Why do I always want one more piece of cheese with Metta, Fido? You should go, and because this happened, this fellow went to go and see a psychiatrist. What's your problem? He said, no, I think I'm a dog. So the psychiatrist said, okay, get up on the couch. He said, no, I'm not allowed. So you got a... In other words, the Pavlovian dog, in other words, when the meditation is played, you still have to stop at 10:30 and 5 p.m. to eat. Where does that matter? Someone will save some food for you. And at 5 p.m. it's only just cheese or whatever. We can save some cheese for you. But even if you're really sort of bothered about that, we'll save you a bone. You're a dog, you said. Oh, just come over here and I'll give you a pat. But when you have habitual responses like that, it's just the mindfulness can actually help stop those habitual responses. But how that mindfulness works, it's a simile of what I call the simile of a snake. Not the Buddha simile of the snake, because in the jungles in Thailand, and there were jungles in those days, after the talks you'd have to walk back to your hut in the darkness. And there were snakes around. And they were venomous snakes. And you didn't have any sandals a lot of the time because they would fall apart. And the flashlights, if you did have a torch, a flashlight, the batteries were always, dead. You couldn't see very much because it was, legitimately poor. And so that it was dangerous. There were snakes around. So I always would tell myself, look, there's snakes around. It's dangerous. So when you were walking back, you didn't walk talking with somebody. You weren't sort of, discussing or thinking about the deeper meaning of dependent origination. Your awareness was right in front of you on the path. And whenever, you saw like a shadow, that's as much as you could see, just a shadow along the path. You didn't know whether it was a stick, whether it was a snake or what it was. So you'd either jump over it or go by another way. I was always on the lookout for the snake. That was why it never bit me. The same way that we always have little problems in meditation, like the habit of you have to stop at meal times or at tea times. That's a habit. That's like a little snake. So you tell yourself, I'm going to be on the lookout for that. And when, you know, it gets to the bell goes or the gong is rung and I want to get up and have something to eat, I prepare myself, first of all, I'm not going to move. And you find you're just about to move and get up the old habits and you resist that. And you sit down and carry on. Even if it's just for 10 minutes. Now the food will still be there for you, but it means you just resist those habits. So one of the anecdotes was there was one of those monks, friends, who was in the Vietnam War, a Marine. He actually signed up for that to get tougher. And he got shot in the back of the head in Vietnam, evacuated, was told by the Marine doctor he would be blind for the rest of his life, determined he would commit suicide as soon as he possibly could. When the bandages were taken off, the doctors were surprised he could see. His sight was perfect. And eventually, on a pension for, you know, for being wounded in the war, he just played around for a while and then eventually got to Thailand and got inspired by someone like Ajahn Chah, became a monk. But because of his injury, you know, he would suffer from epileptic fits from time to time. It was just part of just, you know, losing a bit of his brain. And he overcame those epileptic fits by just simple acts of mindfulness. All he did was really be aware of, you know, how that epileptic fit developed. It didn't just come out of nowhere. He could actually see the precursor, you know, the signs, the warning signs. And at first he could only catch them a few seconds before the fit happened. But then he kept aware until he could catch them so early that he said, there's going to be a fit happens if I don't take alternative action. And he'd usually just go into his room, whatever he was doing, go into his room and just relax. And that was the end of his epileptic fits. And it was a wonderful example of how you can see this Pavlovian response, you know, of, you know, your buttons, somebody presses them and you get angry and upset. That's usually common with a partner, a marriage. After a while they know you and they can just make you upset or make you crave. And so you know those buttons. And so you can actually see them just, especially the sickness like an epileptic fit, you could see it just about to happen. And caught it earlier and earlier and earlier. And mindfulness gave him alternative doors to go through, not the same old habitual responses. So that's why the mindfulness, if you can catch it earlier and earlier, it can actually change habits. And you know, talking about sort of relationships, sometimes you know that people just can argue so much in a marriage and they don't want to say nasty things to one another. They're both good people. It's just bad habits. Bad habits of talking to one another in a negative way. So if you want to sort of stop that, you just make the resolution, look, when my partner says something nasty to me, I'll say something nice back in return. You keep resolving to do that. And then you can actually see yourself getting wound up during a conversation. And that your mindfulness catches you before you just respond with negativity. And you can break the cycle. So that's, you know, how mindfulness can stop habits. After deep meditation, I saw my body and mind are all suffering. I screamed inside, gosh, body, feeling, thinking are all suffering. Later I reflected upon those vivid experiences and I assumed that I just experienced, saw the first noble truth. Am I right? Thank you. Who knows? So, yeah, it's, you screamed inside, but it's, instead of screaming inside, feel so much joy inside of you, really understand the noble truths. Because that's one of those, it was a photograph which was taken, I think it was in England, Ajahn Chah was describing stuff, and it was based on a statue, I think, in Buddhadasa's monastery. And it was this person, his hands up high like this, so much joy, so much ecstasy. And the caption was, joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. wonderful little deep saying. Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. So it's not your fault you're suffering. It's not your fault. It's not your fault you can't control your body and you get sick. It's not your fault that you can't tell new jokes every time. It's not... because this is our world. This is the nature. It's out of control. It's not up to you. This is where people, they come to meditation, they come to Buddhism, just because they think, oh, if I can only be a bit more wise and just react in a more appropriate way, then I won't suffer anymore. And you try that for a while, you realize there's still suffering going on. And why? It's because you're born. There was the Buddhist coroner. And the Buddhist coroner got the sack from his job. And the reason he got the sack from his job, that every time he filled in the death certificate, the cause of death, he wrote birth. So why did she die? Because she was born. That is incredibly deep. Which means the only way you can stop suffering is don't get born next time, stupid. Okay. Please explain in English. Metta, mudita, karuna, and upeka meditation. Please explain, not at the speed of a Japanese bullet train, but the speed of an English tram. Thank you. Okay, we may be here all night because the train is stuck because of snow. So English metta mudita in slow. Metta is just, it's opening the door of your heart to all beings. In other words, it's just allowing them to be. It is not, may all beings be happy and well. Because if you're sick and someone comes up to you and says, I've been wishing you may be happy and well for such a long time, you feel so guilty, such a failure, that after all this monk's chanting, that you're still sick. You feel such a failure. But metta is not telling you what to do, but it's saying, whatever you do, I will still respect and care for you. Which is one of the reasons why, whenever I go traveling and people say to me, have a good journey, I tell them, no, I will not follow your instructions. Who do you think you are to tell me to have a good journey? If I have a good journey, I'll have one because I want to, not because you tell me. And if I want to have a bad journey, that is my right. I will not be commanded by you. And when you say, may you get well, I say, what are you talking about? You know, you get sick. That is part of life, to be sick, and I demand my right to get sick. So bat out and stop telling me to get better. So you can see what happens. May all beings be happy and well. What happens there is you force beings to be happy and well. Why don't you let beings choose? The real loving kindness is not, you know, telling your husband, may you be happy and well, otherwise I'm divorcing you.
Instead, this, the door of my heart is open to you no matter what happens, no matter how you are. So metta is this beautiful openness and kindness. It's the caring without curing. And the karuna is that particular type of metta to people who are suffering in pain. Just, you know, empathizing with them and just giving them the skillful means so that they can overcome their sickness and pain if they want to. But sometimes we learn so much from sickness and pain. Sometimes you wonder, should you take away that opportunity to learn what life is? Even examples of, you know, when kids, you know, would play around and get dirty and scrape their knees and have minor infections, and that's the way they built up immunity. So by trying to bring up children in cotton wool, in a hermetically sealed environment, where they're totally sterile, so, you know, to try and keep them happy and well, you know, is that good for them? It's an interesting argument. So karuna is just sort of giving a bit of kindness and freedom when people are suffering. And mudita is one of the nicest ones. That is where someone else is having a wonderful time. And you don't feel jealous. Why are they got jhanas? This is their first retreat. And they have never served in this monastery, never given any donations. They don't even keep the precepts. And they come in here and just roll in and get jhanas and then they roll out again. That's really unfair. And I've been working hard and doing so much and serving this Buddhist society for so many years and, oh, it really makes you sick. He's Anguli Mala, and I haven't killed anybody, and he becomes enlightened, I don't. Unfair. So, that is jealousy, and it's totally wasted opportunity. But somebody else comes, and they've got totally enlightened, no matter who they are. It feels so wonderful, well done, it's so inspiring that these things happen. It's being inspired when you see other people's goodness and kindness and peace and wisdom. It's the total opposite of being jealous. So when you see somebody get some wonderful results, you think, it's so wonderful, this is happening in our world. Sadhu, 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 which means that you rejoice in other people's happiness. Why not? And upekkha is just, instead of equanimity, that's been overused, is contentment. So content, you don't want anything. So you're not trying to change the world or change yourself. You're at peace with it. I hope that wasn't the speed of a Japanese bullet train, but more the speed of decision making in our committee. But I shouldn't really say that, should I? I'll get into trouble again. Please delete that from the tape. Dear Ajahn, every great monk, history of Buddhism, or any book describes the best posture to meditate is seated cross-legged. Is there any truth behind this? Best why? How did you know what every great... What about every great nun? Stop being so gender specific. Or any book. What do books know? Have you ever seen a book meditating? So, any great monk, history of Buddhism, know the best posture to meditate, sitting cross-legged. Is there any truth behind this? No. Easy. Because sometimes, look, I got a really nice meditation once when I had scrub typhus. And I had a fever for about 3 or 4 weeks. And I didn't know what was going on. But after, you know, 3 or 4 weeks of that, I was just so low energy. We've never actually been as low energy as that. And you were just, nothing was working, everything ached. And it wasn't a very nice hospital to be in. And then, after a while, I thought, I just got, no, Ajahn Chah, you know, great help. Just came, you know, it was a great help, but, you know, just not what I really expected. He came to see me in the hospital. And I was only a very young monk, and I thought, wow, this great teacher has come to see me. Woo! And of course, you all know what he said. He came up to me and said, Brahma Wangsa, so you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he left. And the trouble is, you know, it just, it was true. You can't argue with him. So his wisdom was way up there. It's just his bedside manner needed a bit of work. It was good. So there you were, just really feeling just like, you know, a tea bag which has been drained many times. And then what happened was, I thought, oh, I just might as well meditate. And I got one of these really nice meditations. You couldn't feel your aching, tired body. And it was blissful. If you think it's blissful when your body disappears now, imagine when it's really aching and tired. Just the contrast was so great. It was wonderful, just enjoying. When I came out, one of the first things I noticed was my posture. And I've never seen any monk or nun describe that posture. I've never seen it in a book. One leg this way, another leg that way. You know, arm over here, arm over there. Because, you know, you're in bed, just, you know, for weeks, just with a fever, just whichever way that the body wanted to go, and that's what it was. So that, what that told me, you can get into the deepest of meditations in any posture. Let the body decide. Dear Ajahn, can we have nimitta with eyes open? It's possible, but if you can't get it with your eyes closed, you ain't going to get it with your eyes open. So get it with your eyes closed, first of all. Dear Ajahn, I just want to say thank you. Great. Then why is there 4 more lines afterwards written on here? Even though I haven't experienced jhana, my meditations are more consistently enjoyable. It's like I found a meditation map. Thanks. Excellent. So more questions should be like that. Just praise without complaining and just, you know, it's nice. No, I'm only joking. After deep meditation, I saw my body and... Oh, I screamed inside. I've had this one already. That's the one about First Noble Truth. After listening to your advice and rested for a few days, my body and mind is in happy condition and bursting with energy to meditate. But it is so full of energy, like the Energizer battery bunny, that my mind can't stop to want to jump from walking to sitting. And so how do I slow myself down? Thank you, Ajahn. There is the kangaroo walking meditation. You're the junior most loved. Now, come on. So you've seen this before. This is the type of meditation you should do in such a state. Very energized. The mind can't stop to want to jump from walking to sitting. So you do Australia. All remember that in Buddhism, every culture, when Buddhism goes to China, it changes a little bit. Sri Lanka a little bit. Thailand, we have the Thai forms of Buddhism. And Korean forms of Buddhism. And of course we have to have Australian type of Buddhism, especially with walking meditation. Australian style. So first of all, your posture. You sit with the legs side like that, very good. And here we go. You put your hands, kangaroo, and you don't, get ready, you don't do left foot, right foot, you just jump. So whoever said that, wrote this, you have to try kangaroo walking meditation. And it makes you happy, and it also, everybody who sees that, that makes them happy. And that is a good example of karuna practice. Taking away people's boredom and making them happy. That's karuna meditation. You do that so everybody can see it. And of course I am not a hypocrite, because last December in Penang, that usually I ask someone else to do this, but there was no one else there. I was the only monk. And there was no nuns to exploit. So I had to do it myself. It's my karma, I suppose, my vipaka. So I got to the end of the stage and I did the kangaroo walking meditation. And I thought that was fine, except as soon as I started doing, I was focused in front of me, a few people got their iPhones out and they videoed me. And it's on YouTube somewhere. Ajahn Brahm demonstrating himself kangaroo walking meditation. So it's okay to have energy. You have to make use of it. If you know how to make use of it, it's like you have a Ferrari car, really powerful. If you really know how to use it, you can really use it so well. If the past predicts the future and we can let go of our past and forgive, does that mean we can change our karma? Yeah. Of course, you can change your karma. Otherwise, how could Angulimala become a total arahat? So, your karma, you got a huge store of bad karma. Not just from this life, but from many other lives as well. Inexhaustible store of bad karma. True. You've also got a huge amount of good karma as well. Also inexhaustible good karma. So why do bad things happen? Why do good things happen? Because sometimes if something bad happens to you, you get negative. You blame somebody, you blame yourself. And that brings more bad karma to you. It's like you tune in to the negative bandwidth. Bandwidth or frequency, and you bring in all your bad karma from the past. And that, to me, is totally ridiculous. Instead, and you can't wipe out your bad karma, it's just too much of it. You tune out from it. And your good karma, which is so inexhaustible, allow that to come. And how do you do that? By having this wonderful positive mind. And this mudita, just enjoying the wonderful kindness and giving and practice of all the other people, you can see around you. And all the people who serve on this retreat. People like, Bianca, who manages, she doesn't get paid for this. All the people who come and bring you the best food, they don't get paid for it. They come just the joy of it. And all the people who built this jhana grove, and including me, work really hard on this. And what is really nice to get mudita about is just on this side, I always like to mention this, where you are sitting there, the building company assured me that this will be finished in, in January or maybe the latest, February 2009? They said it can be finished in January. You sure? Well, I think so, but the latest February. So that's when we decided to have our grand opening in April. But when it got to February, it's not our fault, but contractors, what they're like. So it wasn't finished. But it finished in March. When it came to March, bit of delays, but it'll be finished in April. And when we had our grand opening, even the night before, it wasn't finished. And we had this bamboo floor, the bamboo contractors, they got fed up and they said, right, we're going home. They left us in the lurch. There was concrete there. So what happened? It's late in the afternoon, 5, 6 o'clock, and we had a big ceremony the following day. Ah! So what happens in such situations? Just like in the movies, you have the 7th Cavalry. We have the Sangha. So a lot of monks came here, worked all night, about 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, to finish the bamboo floor where you're now sitting. So, in the following morning, we could have the opening ceremony and start the first retreat here. So, the monks you have over here, they are not princesses. They are not lazy. When it really is the time to come and work, they work. I used to work very hard, as you very well know. Sometimes that I still do a little bit of work, but I don't tell you, because the last time I was fixing up one of the roofs here in Jhana Grove, and the previous caretaker was here, and she took a video of me and put it online. And I got told off so much. They said, Ajahn Brahm, number one, you're too heavy to work on a roof. We're not quite sure if the rafters will take. But also, you know, you might fall off. You're too valuable. So you're banned from going on the roof. Really unfair. So anyway, so every now and again when you guys aren't watching, I can do something when there's no cameras around. But that's really dangerous these days. Paparazzi around, photographed everyone. But it's wonderful to see just, and every time I tell that story, how do you feel? Great gratitude and joy and happiness. Just how, you know, we all work together to produce a wonderful place where people can meditate. And now that's how I feel. It's a great joy to give. We give as much as we can as well. And that joy of giving makes this place a wonderful facility. And then once you have that positive mind, mind of gratitude, kindness, then you're bringing up all of your past good karma. You're actually tapping in the joy, the gratitude, this wonderful positive which makes you want to do good things. Which makes you feel that you're not such a failure. Which makes you start to get so peaceful and so joyful. Healing sicknesses, taking away anger and other diseases, and you feel great. So we have huge stores of good karma and bad karma. But we can tap into either. That is our skill. And eventually you get so skilled at this, you let go of all your bad karma. That's called streaming. The songs in my head won't stop. The past keeps reappearing. The fantasies are getting more and more creative. If those are not enough, my eyelids keep moving around. This is getting out of control. Please advise. Ah! Of course they're getting out of control. I told you that. Stop trying to control them. Your songs in my head won't stop. Amazing. Those could be groundbreaking music. That could be the beginning of your new career. Sort of, you know, just eat your heart out, Elton John. Your songs are far better. And the past keep reappearing. Amazing. So how far past, how far in the past can you go? See if you can go earlier and earlier and get your past life. That'd be really cool. The fantasies are getting more and more creative. Amazing. Send them to Steven Spielberg. This could be a book, you know, with marvelous ideas and fantasies about. And that's where J.K. Rowling must have started. She probably went to a meditation retreat and had all these fantasies about wizards and magic wands. So who knows? So, in other words, welcome them instead of trying to get rid of them. And when you welcome them, thank you for coming to visit me, then you don't feed them with negativity and you undermine their source of power and they get less and less and less. The emperor's, the monster who came into the emperor's palace. That's what works. I told that the first day. If you haven't heard that yet, and if people keep complaining, I tell the same story again and again and again. So, emperor's palace, the monster in the emperor's palace, that's what works. The more I meditated on just be, the more I opened the door of my heart to whatever there was, the more I felt lost and disorientated. But somehow my body was comfortable, and this was a sense of silence inside me. Excellent. Am I meditating correctly? Yes. When you first said about that, being disoriented and lost, I said, if you ever read The Art of Disappearing, that's the whole point of this, is getting lost. In other words, you losing your defilements, losing your wanting, losing your pettiness, losing your sicknesses, losing your mental illnesses, losing all these defilements and all your... So that's what we're supposed to be doing. Letting go means losing things. Which is why I said at the end of that book, the end of the foreword to the book, sort of, if you understand this book, then you'll understand that I wish you all get lost. That was my wish, out of kindness. Your ego, your defilement, your wanting, your ill will, your sickness. Lose them all. But sometimes people would come up to me and they said, look at you, you're just a muck. You're not contributing to the world. You know, you had a great degree and you just really failed. You're a loser, Ajahn Brahm. Because telling people they're a loser is supposed to be like really a nasty thing to say to people, you loser. When they tell me, oh, you're a loser, I say, thank you, well done, at last I'm appreciated. It's great being a loser. You know, losing all your worries, losing all your possessions, going, be able to go, losing all your responsibilities so you can fly like a bird. So, amazing, getting lost. What a wonderful thing that is. So when people call me a loser, I say, well done. You really understood the purpose of the life of a Buddhist monk or a nun. We're losers. And the more you lose, the happier you are, the freer of possessions and burdens, because you don't own your possessions, the possessions own you. You don't own your mobile phone. Your phone owns you. It's calling at you now, give me some attention. The important emails are coming, SMSs, got to check them out. You don't possess them, they possess you. So it's wonderful if you lose things. And of course, the greatest loser, the biggest loser. Who is the biggest loser?
The Lord Buddha.
Lost everything. So it's free. So we're not here to get more things. Ajahn Chah would say this often. You don't meditate to attain things. You meditate to let go of things. To lose things. Not to gain them. You understand that? You understand the path of meditation. We're losers. Welcome to the Losers Club. Losing rock. Okay, but your sense of silence inside you, amazing, you felt lost and disoriented, you're going to places you've never been before, that's why you feel disorientated, things are disappearing, you know, things like your body, things like even your choice, look at this place, how much choice do you have here, the menu. Bianca, do you put out menus every morning and lunchtime? See what's on the menu? course there's no meaning. You've got hardly any choice there. That's the trouble with choice these days. Choice is so confusing. Just like, you know, there's a funny story coming off, because just like that migrant came to Australia and was taken to a supermarket for the first time. Never been to a supermarket before. And they saw this on the supermarket shelf, powdered milk. All you need to do is add hot water and you get milk just as it's fresh. Then, wow, this is amazing, powdered milk. In the old country, we had to find a cow. And very lucky if they weren't kicked in the back by the cow and milk it. And that's how we got milk. This is so convenient. Just out of powder and hot water, you get milk. And then the next one was powdered mashed potatoes. Just add water, stir it up, and you get mashed potato. Oh, in the old country, we used to have to get put the potatoes in the field, wait for them to grow, then dig them up again, scrape away all of the dirt, boil them, peel them, and then smash them to bits. That's how we get these days. Powdered mashed potato, just add water, you get instant mashed potato. Because of our audience today, like noodles. Like, what's the little noodles you have? Not yet. I don't take noodles. I know the monks, some of the monks like these. What the noodles are the monks like? Tom Yam Goong. Whatever, I don't know anyway. Noodles, instant noodles. Yeah, in the old country, you had to get what do you get? You get the rice or you get the wheat. You got to sort of paste it together and just put it through this noodle machine. And then you got to boil it or fry it and season it. It takes a long time to get some noodles. But here, instant noodles, just a packet. I'm sure many of you got some in your cottages, just in case. Adding hot water and you get instant noodles. They're amazing. But then, what they really shocked the new migrant to Australia. Went round another corner of the supermarket and he couldn't believe his eyes. Baby powder. In the old country, you have to get married. In Australia, baby powder. Just wanted to get a baby. But it's terrible, isn't it, with choice? All the things you want to choice and just what type of baby you're going to get. There's going to be a time when you have the choices. Anyway, just be comfortable. Yes. So this is how we let go and allow things to disappear. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if there is an age cut off for new monks and nuns and the monastery in Perth, an age cut off. There was in the suttas, there was, Theragata. There was a man who was 119 years old. 119. And that's when he decided to ordain as a monk. So they let him ordain as a monk. 3 months later, he became arahat, fully enlightened. And 3 months later, he passed away. We call that leaving it to the last minute. We managed just to squeeze it in. So usually it's on case-by-case basis. And especially if you are a big monastery, then of course, you know, there's more opportunity to look after elderly monks and elderly nuns. But if you're in a small community, it means the amount of care required will mean the monks or nuns have nothing to do except to look after you all the time, which means that they do get tired. And, you know, we do have so many duties to perform, you know, as monks and nuns in our modern age. It's not just sitting down doing nothing all day. So it does really take a lot of effort and a lot of time.
So that's why it has to be individual monasteries just really have to make up their choice. If a person's been a monk or a nun a long time, or especially a supporter for a long time, of course they're given sort of preference. But it's also the case now, because of the rules and regulations of getting visas, you know, if you are sort of elderly from overseas, it's much difficult to get your visas, simply because the government is looking and saying, wow, now this person is going to get old soon, which means they're going to take a lot of money to look after. And so they sometimes ask you, you know, to make sure you get your own health insurance. But, you know, this is the sort of practical practical troubles. So in order to avoid that, an age cut-off, ordain now, while there is still the chance. Grab the day. So who knows what might happen next? So, if you want to ordain now, that is the best time. Like the best time to meditate is now. The best time to renounce, now. The best time to become a monk or a nun? Oh, come on! Now. And people used to keep saying, what if everybody became a monk or a nun? Who would feed us? Now that is not a question anymore. I've seen these robots being built in Japan and Korea, and they can look after you, they can feed you, they can do everything. So it's great, we don't need. And driving you to appointments, we've got driverless Uber cars, so we don't need actually Anagarikas anymore, soon they'll be just not necessary. You know, if the monk needs to go to Nonamara to give a talk, you know, we just, you know, get our Uber car and type in Nonamara, and we go and meditate in there all the way to Nonamara Temple, and then we just give the talk, we can come back, we don't need Anagarikas, even people serving us food, that can we just, you know, press a button, and then we get the food. And what else do we get? If you want your chanting, because, you know, people sometimes they need some chanting because something is happening in their life, you just get like the drive-through, and that's just like, you know, McDonald's, but this is McBrahms, and you have the selection there, you know, what do you want the chanting for? The chanting for, you know, like a birth, or the chanting for, say, marriage, or marriage problems, or selling a house, or because of sickness, or because, you know, all the different types of chanting. You can, you know, press the button, and they get your earphone, and, you know, you get the sort of the chanting which you require, and always say, do you want holy water with that? Not fries with that, holy water. And this little nozzle comes out, over you. And then if you want, you know, advice, it comes to a doctor, because it's all the same advice, which you keep on giving. So you press, you know, because the meditation, you haven't got the jhanas yet, or how to deal with nimittas, so nimitta problems, you press that one, and you get sort of the same, there's still forest pool, and just, or you get sort of too much thinking, oh, the monster in the emperor's palace, you press that one, and you get really depressed, the two bad bricks. And so you have all the different stories, you just press there. And at the end, you know, you just give your donation. And that's done. Wouldn't it be wonderful? That'd be 24/7. You wouldn't have to worry about, oh, this poor monk is getting tired. Or, you know, there's not enough monks available today. So, you know, that'd be the automatic monastery of the future. So all the time, the monks would just be meditating all the time. And the nuns would just wouldn't have to do any cleaning or any washing up because that would be done by the robots. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I think that'd be a wonderful a future for monastic life. You don't say, but I think it's quite attractive. Having to work hard. No, you need to do the personal touch. So the age cut off for new monks and nuns at the monastery in Perth. At Bodhidharma Monastery, we don't have an age cut-off. So it really depends on can we handle it or not. So the monks, yeah, we talk amongst ourselves. Especially if a person has really, 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 really looked after us for a long time, and then they want to come and live, you know, okay, they served us, we've got gratitude.
as far as we possibly can. But sometimes you can't do anything. It's just too much. You know, even it hasn't happened, but there was one person who was in a prison. We were trying, this is interesting stuff. We were sort of going to visit him in prison, and he was a really, really good person. You know, he kept his cell so clean, had a Buddha statue, meditating, just no TV or anything, just studying Dharma and meditating just so much. And then he was coming up for parole, and he said, well, you know, can I come and stay at Bodhinyana Monastery and just become a monk? And so, you know, we checked on him, and he was a child sex offender. And we talked with the lawyers, and they said, can't do it. You know, because of the insurance wouldn't cover you, and because the insurance wouldn't cover you, they have all sorts of difficulties and problems. It was just so disappointing for me that, you know, because of the fear we have, that it meant that he wouldn't be able to be around the dharmas and kids playing around. He wouldn't be able to do that. So there was a person whose karma just was not good enough in this lifetime because of an act which he had done for actually ordaining as a monk. For me, I felt sad about that. The forgiveness and the fear, which was, you know, enshrined in law. You know, you couldn't give him a chance. And apparently from all the monks who visited him in jail, he was just an amazing person. And chance of reoffending again was pretty zero. But we were constrained by laws and regulations, the just in cases, because, you know, if he did offend, basically that, you know, the courts, the state would basically just take all the money from Buddhist society, would close down. Difficult situations. I don't know, sometimes the regulations, yeah, they're supposed to safeguard, but sometimes we're not allowed to take risks, calculated risks. That's what I feel anyway. But anyway, so that is, if your age, then it really depends. The Nuns Monastery is just starting out, so I think they have an age limit of 50, but you see, Venerable Gotami got under the radar. So, yeah, so she managed to get in and become a really, really inspiring, good bhikkhuni. So, it really depends. One of those things which are indeterminate. So, but still, even so, that we're still building huts whenever we can. There's no end of people wanting to become monks these days, and nuns as well. And that is one of our problems. And again, because of bushfire regulations, for those of you who know, what was it, 1991, we had a big bushfire, came here, a crown fire, 46 degrees centigrade before the fire came. And I was there at the time. Trees, boom, exploding, uncontrollable in the afternoon. And we were fine. None of the buildings were destroyed. And so they're very well built. And so sometimes you say, well, you know, just build these things. I think it's more important, like having the opportunity for monks, to have monks. If some of them get killed, well, you know, that's a risk we're taking. We don't really sort of die, we just get reincarnated, that's all. So we're so risk averse to death. You know, it's okay to go surfing and swimming in the ocean and get bitten by sharks, but we're not allowed to build huts in the forest because of the lesser danger of bushfires. Anyway, I'm just moaning and groaning and whinging. I have to whinge because that's my character. English. Okay, so that's enough for this evening. So hopefully that we have all sorts of different questions here. And hopefully that some of the answers are okay for you. And It is sin. Usually when we do these 9-day retreats, there's usually one evening I disappear so that you can ask the question of the nuns. So remember, Venerable Sisters, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So usually it's a Friday, I go in on a Friday, but this week I'm going to go in on a Wednesday evening. It was just a big ceremony for Buddhism in the Parliament House. So I just wanted to warn you, Venerable, that on Wednesday evening that you are invited to lead the chanting and answer the question. So that you have exactly 2 days to get enlightened or get lost so people can't find you on Wednesday evening. And no need to be afraid, because it's a wonderful time here when people, because they see you here, they really respect you and they want to find out about you. And they don't ask difficult questions. It's usually nice, interesting questions. Why do you become a nun? What's happening in Santi Monastery? You know, where Ajit and Jaya are from. And, you know, how's it going there? How's your ordination progressing? Because, you know, when people get to know you, they get inspired. So that'll be happening on Wednesday evening. Okay, so you've got 2 days either to get enlightened or plan your escape. No, they're all very, very good teachers. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.